We can get started on our final of this series. So the series is called Be Your Own Therapist. And Denise, it's fine to come along for this class because each evening we've had on a standalone topic. So, and because the whole point of Buddhist psychology, which this course is based on, is so that we can get strong enough and we can become our own teacher, our own therapist, our own guru. That's the end point. We need help along the way so that we can develop those qualities within ourselves so it's sustainable. So as it's the last class in this series, we're kind of having a look at how to make things good in the beginning, the middle, and the end. So at the beginning of these six classes, we had how to set our motivation. We went really in depth into that. And then the middle classes have been some really poignant, handy hints for life, how to keep our mind happy, how to focus on what are the causes for happiness, not just kind of panicking and grasping after it. And tonight, then how to have a good end. Because it's possible to do all, to be, there's a, I think there's even a Tibetan saying about when something was really fantastic, they'll say, oh, it was good in the beginning, the middle, and the end. And that's like the highest praise that you could possibly have. Ah, here we are. Here's Tammy, and here's Erin, Troy, Marnie, and Sophia. Fantastic. I saw your names there on the bookings and was, very happy to see all of those names. Welcome along. The structure of the class, you can unmute at any time. You can jump in and ask me a question. You can put a question into the chat. Whatever's more comfortable for you, you can turn your camera on. You can have it off. I'm easy with that. I know how we can get camera fatigue sometimes. And in a moment, we'll do a very short meditation to set our purpose and our motivation for being here. And then I've got some slides on the screen share that will help us go through the main points tonight. So because it's about dedication tonight, I'm just interested, is there anyone here who's had something come to an end joyously? An event, a situation, a relationship, a project, anyone? What was it that came to an end joyously that you're really happy about? The other thing is, well, what about something that came to an end disastrously? We need some examples here. So you can raise your hand, you can put it in the chat, whatever it is. When something came to an end, could even be when someone's died, someone's left. It could be whatever disaster or whatever joyous thing. We've got to have some examples of situations coming to an end. So I've given you a moment to think about it. Rachel, what comes to mind?
Well, the first thing that came to mind was our event on Sunday with Geshe Tsultrim. The teachings and him giving refuge, and it was just so lovely hearing him talk, and then everyone, I don't know, everyone was just glowing and so happy afterwards. It was just so beautiful. So yeah.
So that's a good one. And so when we have an event that was so wonderful, and this happens often if you go to a concert or a really good movie, you kind of go, oh no, I don't want it to end. And then when it does end, you want to go back and think about it some more to keep that feeling going for a while, isn't it? We want to reflect on it
Exactly,
and
and keep the joy going, basically.
keep the joy going.
Yeah.
And then how do we reflect on it? What's the process that we do?
Just think about the good stuff that,
That's it. That's
yeah,
right.
things that we enjoyed, that we, yeah, the benefits that we
Spot
got from
on.
it. Yeah.
So we think about the good stuff. We focus on everything that went well, the benefits from it, all the different people that were happy, all the wonderful things that happened to others, all the things that went well. So we focus on all those benefits. So that is the key. So we're going to have a look how we can incorporate that into dedication, how to actually dedicate everything that we do so that it becomes very powerful, so that all of our energy isn't just scattered, so it doesn't just kind of sink. If we do good dedications, it means that we won't be distracted from our goals. Or to put it another way, if we find ourselves being distracted, trying a little bit here, a little bit there, never finishing anything, a lot of it is to do with either the missing motivation or the missing dedication. If you find that it's very easy to remember terrible events and it takes effort to remember the good things, that's also because we've skimped on the dedication. So it's not the first thing that comes to mind. And for us to continue in this world and to have a zest for life, to have the energy to be able to help others and not burn out, we need to keep the energy going. And how we do that is by doing a good dedication. That's how we don't lose hope or lose direction or lose our strength. Dedication's especially important in times of transition when things change. And when the unexpected happens, that you've dedicated everything up to that point. Times of transition when someone's died, even when a pet has died, you can actually dedicate for them on their behalf and make it very meaningful and help that being in their passage to the next life. And when we've completed a project, it's really important to dedicate. So I've seen on some of those TV shows, grand designs they always have when they've got to the roof of the house, they have the topping out ceremony. So it's kind of like this pagan thing that once you've put the roof on, which is kind of like the completion of the structure, it's really important to have a topping out ceremony to make sure that the life of the house is long and auspicious. So it's kind of like that. A dedication is like that. We've got to have it. Otherwise, there's a danger of that things will all fall down. So with that introduction, then let's take a moment to do a short meditation and set our motivation for tonight. I'm going to get our screen share up as a little inspiration for our breathing meditation. So like I've said, it's a course, be your own therapist. Buddhist psychology is very powerful, quite radical. And for our nine round breathing, I'll explain how to do it in a moment, but let's first settle our posture. We're going to try and make a nice balance between putting some energy into keeping your spine straight and your posture feeling alert and engaged, ready to engage in the class. So not kind of settling down to sleep, but they even say having your shoulders, sorry, your elbows out a little from the torso, like a bird about to take flight. So your elbows are out, your whole posture is alert. Spine naturally straight. Hands just gently in the lap. Pull your chin inwards, tuck it in a little. And once the posture is fairly straight and upright, then on the basis of that, relax the shoulders and release tension, all that built up stress and tension from the neck and the shoulders. Just let them drop. Feel the tension rolling along the shoulders and off the tips of the shoulders. With every out breath, release the tension and busyness of the day. So now your body has this nice balance between keeping a upright posture and being relaxed, and your mind too, releasing all the busyness of the day, but still staying alert. Then to help clear our concentration, the nine round breathing. So imagine first that you're breathing out through your left nostril, and as you breathe out all of the disturbing emotions and upsets and worries and anxieties in the form of black smoke, and you release them, you breathe them out. And as you breathe in, imagine breathing in through your right nostril, blissful golden light that floods through you like warm sunshine on a cold winter's day. And this light fills your whole body, your mind, and you absorb all of the enlightening qualities that you wish to develop. So, three long, leisurely breaths out through the left nostril, in through the right. And when you've completed those three, swapping the nostrils over. So now breathing out through the right nostril, releasing all of the disturbed states of mind, the negative emotions, the upsets, doubts, and worries, all the discomfort, the turmoil. Think of it as inner toxicity that you are breathing out, releasing. You breathe out in that form of black smoke. And as you breathe in, the radiant, blissful, golden light, as it flows into you, feel you become completely energized, your mind blissful and clear, and you absorb all of the good qualities, patience and wisdom, kindness, energy. So, with the nostrils swapped over, three long, leisurely breaths. And then for the final three, breathing out through both nostrils. As you breathe out that toxic smoke, all those negativities, I feel it begins to, the smoke begins to grow light gray, then a bit more like mist as you get down to the very subtle ones. And as you breathe in through both nostrils, again, feel this blissful, energizing light flow into you and absorb into every atom of your body. And your mind becomes very alert and blissful and relaxed, very clear. So three times through both nostrils. And then for just a few moments, letting your focus gently rest on the rising and falling of the breath. Aware of that natural spaciousness and luminosity of your mind, without letting any other thoughts or distractions, take hold of your focus. Just having your focus on that rising and falling of the breath, breathing in and out clear light. Then we can adjust our motivation for tonight. So whatever the motivation was, our purpose for being here, that's our starting point. But we adjust it to become really heartfelt and altruistic and including the benefit of everybody. So for our immediate goals, but also our long-term liberation and lasting happiness and peace. For the development of all of our qualities, all the way up to full enlightenment, to be able to benefit everyone around us and never bring them harm, and in fact, to work towards the best kind of benefit that we can bring others, liberating all living beings from their sufferings, bringing them to a state of lasting happiness, and everything else that comes in between. And so, with this good-heartedness and good intentions, then we have a short motivation prayer. What is the purpose of being alive today? It must be something more important than drinking coffee. Today, I will develop bodhicitta, leading to the peaceful path of liberation and full awakening for the benefit of all beings. From this moment on, until I go to sleep, I shall stay aware of every action of my body, speech, and mind. Wherever possible, I shall try to help, and at the very least, I will not harm. Okay, so that sets the scene. So since we're talking about dedication, we're going to spend a moment just how do we rate our day? How do we do a day, we have a day, and then we dedicate at the end, or we have an event and we dedicate at the end. So how do we look back on the day and how do we determine whether it was a good day or not? Generally, if things go well for us, if we don't have many problems, we'll say it was a good day. Or if we got to enjoy some music, enjoy some good food, catch up with friends. All of those things that in that happiness class was about what we get from the world. It's very based on our senses. Our things go well, we're not hampered in any of our plans, nothing breaks or stuffs up. Then we'll go, it was a good day. But we can look a little deeper than that and actually ask, well, it was a pleasant day, but that doesn't necessarily mean it was a good day. It means it was enjoyable. But we may also have a really overwhelming day. We might have a day where everything goes wrong and our patience is really tested. And at the end of the day, you're exhausted, but you've managed to not snap at anyone, to not give anyone the finger in road rage, to not retaliate. And you might have just made it to zip the lip. And not make things worse. And so then you get home and you're exhausted. It's just like, oh, what a day. So if we look a little deeper, which is the good day? One's pleasant, one's difficult. But is that really just how we're judging our life, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant sensations? Or are we looking just a little deeper? And actually, really, from the point of view of benefiting ourselves and others and creating harmony in the world and not being destructive, not making things worse, not harming others, that day where everything goes wrong and we manage to not retaliate, that's a good day. That's a really good day. That's a day where you contribute to world peace. So when we look back on the day, how do we rate our day? Yeah, it's fine to go, I had a good day or not, but we can tweak it by getting really specific. What do we mean? Was it pleasant or unpleasant? Was it a challenge? Was it overwhelming? Did you win? Did you lose? So sometimes you might be really struggling, but you achieve what you set out for. So then you could count that as good. One question you could ask if you've had a good day or not is how would you rate your kindness to others? So you might have had a five-star day in terms of enjoyment, but did you have a five-star day in terms of being kind to others? And what's more important here? One's a fleeting sensation. Can we even remember the good day that we had? Can we even remember where everything went right? I can't. I just think, oh, yeah, that's how it should be. That's just normal. Everything goes right. I get enough sleep. I have some nice breakfast. All the transport's on time. Everybody's nice to me. Everything goes well. The computer works. Go home, watch a nice show. Nice clean sheets. Go to bed without stress. Yep, great day. Can I remember anything about it? What anybody said to me? Did I accomplish anything? No idea. But how can you rate your kindness to others? That's far more profound and far more important for the well-being of the world. And even if you weren't able to be kind, how successful were you in non-retaliation? If it took every ounce of your energy in your mind, you're going berserk. You're going, oh, I could just kill you. But you don't kill them. And you don't even retaliate. And you just say, have a nice day and put on a smile and walk away. And if it took every ounce of your energy, then that is a good day. How successful were you in non-retaliation? So, in order to dedicate a day, we've even got to look at, well, what kind of day did we have? What are we dedicating here? So just like with kids at school, teachers are encouraged to praise the effort, not praise natural talent. Oh, you're so good at that. Well, maybe you're naturally good at that, and somebody who's not good at it has tried all day to do it. So teachers are taught to praise the effort put in by somebody, not what they're just easily good at. And it's the same for us. So then we can do some divine accounting. At the end of the day, we look back at our day and we congratulate ourselves on the positive. Everything that we did well, that we're happy about, how we spoke, how we acted, how much effort we put in, how much we were able to refrain from making things worse. And make sure you spend some time congratulating yourself. Acknowledging it, appreciating your effort, just like you're your own teacher, praising your efforts. Because you're going to have to bring them to mind. It's not going to be immediately apparent because you'll be in the momentum. You'll be still propelled by trying hard. And that's not necessarily a nice feeling. It's effortful. So you're going to have to step back for a moment and actually recognize your efforts. Which is different from still being propelled, trying. Congratulate yourself on the positive. And then for the negative things, instead of berating yourself, instead of judging and thinking, oh, you're a failure or whatever, acknowledge the things that went wrong, where you busted, where you're not happy, the negativities or afflictions that arose, and then one thing that you could do better, one thing. So while we've got this picture of the pile of the stones, one of the Tibetan lamas in the olden days, before they had calculators or ledgers or anything, journals, at the end of the day, he'd put all the good things that he managed to do, pile of white stones, all the negativities, pile of black stones, and then at the end of the day, which pile had more? Congratulate himself if he did well, give himself a smack on the hand if he, no, got to get it together a bit more tomorrow. So we do some kind of accounting reflection each day. You can do it by little pebbles, you can do it with a ledger, a piece of paper with two columns, positive thoughts. Speech, activities, negative ones, and just write them down. And what you might find is that because you've been putting so much effort into your ethical behavior, you might feel you're really failing here. It's so hard because of the effort you're putting in. And unless you write down the good things in the ledger, you're not going to notice them. You have to bring your attention to them. So I think when you do the ledger, especially if you're being really effortful, you'll find there are a lot more positive things that you've been doing, but they've just got lost in the way. And of as you're propelling yourself through life. And that way it can really help you appreciate the good things that you do. And that gives us energy to continue. So journaling with a determination at the end, having a really simple leisure. And also what great sports coaches do is they get their teams to just try and do something 1% better. So instead of trying to make a huge big change, I think there was some basketball team that actually was way down the bottom of the list. What do I know about sport? And then this coach brought them to win the championships. And how he did it was being just 1% better. And he looked at everything that they did and went, how can we do whatever it is that you do, tie your shoes, have a cup of coffee, diet, whatever, what can we do just 1% better, just finessing everything. And in the end, you're 100% better. So looking back on the day and rating the day, it's about time we had some questions or comments here. How's it going? Does it make sense? Have you got any scenarios or stories or things that you'd like to ask?
One of the things I get a little bit confused about when we talk about kindness, kindness and truth, and I have the scenario I'm thinking of. I have a very difficult relative that I try and support in some ways. They're living at risk and they're incredibly negative, but they have the resources to fix that, but they don't. And they're continually asking me for basically reinforcement for what they're doing, which I can't give. So then they get upset with me and I feel like I'm not being kind, but I feel like to not upset them, I would have to be untruthful. So I find that very conflicting.
Oh, I hear you. And I mean, we all have a situation like that and you have described it beautifully. And it's devastating, isn't it? So what comes to mind is really the first thing what Venerable Rabina says is that especially, say, someone who's undergoing big difficulties, to recognise that it is it's the behaviour, not the person. And so someone asked about their alcoholic brother. And I remember Venerable Rabina saying, don't think of him as an alcoholic brother, because then you're thinking of the problem as the person. So think of them, my dear brother, who is overwhelmed by alcoholism. So the dear brother has all the potential to become a Buddha, just like you and me, just like the Buddha, but at the moment is overwhelmed by all those negativities. So it's the right perspective. And we need to remind ourselves again and again. So the difficult relative, you go, my dear relative, who's overwhelmed by negativities, who's so overwhelmed that it just spreads to everybody. But you start off by saying, my dear relative. And that, reframe it in your own mind, will really help. And then it sounds like you're putting a huge amount of effort into being positive to help their negativity. And you may not get much feedback from that, but believe you me, just having someone like that in your life that can withstand the negativity and not fall over when you're the negative person, it's so important. And not only that, if you are able to actually relate to them as a human being with all that potential rather than to their problem, that will help them see, I'm a human being overwhelmed by a problem. I'm not my problem. I'm not bad. So that's your task, is to be able to do that for them. And if you can, it will make a big difference. And then that will also help with if you're a truth teller or not. So when the Buddha gave advice about how to speak the truth, it had to be more than just true. It had to be truthful. It had to be kind. And it had to be necessary or useful. So timely. So just the truth is no good, because cold, hard truth never sits well, or it's very hard to be skillful about that. So it's got to be truth delivered skillfully and kindly. And so that's where a huge amount of energy and efforts needed, isn't it? So then for you, you kind of figure out how long you can spend with that person, might be 20 minutes, might be half a day, before you become overwhelmed with negativity. You've got to work it out. How long, how many minutes can I do this before it tips over and it goes from me being the positive influence to now I'm being overwhelmed with negativity too. And you make sure you get out of there before it tips. And through your good-heartedness and efforts, then that will naturally be able to extend. So that is a brilliant example, Denise. I hope that's helpful. I just muted you before because there was a bit of echo with my but I can ask to unmute. Let me just turn this down.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you, Mickey. That was really helpful. And
I'm glad you asked because it is such a common scenario.
And you're right. It can be very overwhelming when you get the brunt of the negativity.
Yep. So there's quite a bit of preparation that we have to do before we even see them, that we remember to relate to the person, not the negativity, not the bad behavior. And the more negative someone is appearing, the harder it is to remember that. So it takes a lot of practice. So even that, if you spend your day just trying to prepare for that, you spend your 15 minutes, you kind of lose it and then get out of there before it gets too bad, and then spend the whole day trying to recover from it all. You know, that actually may be a really good day. That may be a 5-star day where you tried up to your utmost limit to benefit and put aside your own discomfort. And you may not get the results today, but that will definitely count. It'll count for your own development, your own resilience, but it'll also count for them, that they'll know you're a safe person to be with. And you love them and care for them regardless of how stupid they are. Because, you know, when we're being stupid and overwhelmed by negativities, we're our worst critics. There's self-loathing that we have. So if someone else can relate to us without that, it really makes all the difference in the world. Okay. Thanks, Tammy. Making sense. No stories. Sorry. Never mind. If something comes up, do let me know. So the next thing that we can have a look at then, so we've been looking back on our day and we can see there's a big difference between having a nice day or being nice to somebody and having a good day, being kind, putting an effort, making our life meaningful. And what derails us is these 8 worldly concerns. And so they are the things that, even with our best intentions, throughout the day, over and over again, we're derailed by them because a lot of them are just based on our physical sensations or our emotional sensations, how we feel, which actually a lot of the time is quite fickle. It's not profound or meaningful. It takes effort to make it profound. So they're in four pairs, something that we're seeking and something that we're avoiding. So we're always seeking pleasure and comfort and nice things and avoiding pain and discomfort. So even in this class tonight, you know, I'll be wriggling on my chair trying to just adjust my position. And while we can wriggle and adjust our comfort, we think everything is fine. But it's only when we can't wriggle, when we're forced to sit still, that we become aware, oh, my leg's killing me and this cushion's so hard. So we kind of think everything is fine because we can most of the time keep on adjusting things until we can't, and then we're devastated. And then we just panic and we try and avoid all the discomfort, the unpleasant things. No, this is horrible. We try and avoid the difficult relatives and all of that. It's like, oh, no, here they are again. Ugh. But it's very superficial, isn't it? And actually, it's got nothing to do with whether something is meaningful or not, whether it's going to be worth it or not. And many times, you know, pain, we have a pain system for a reason, don't we? Our body has a built-in pain system. And can you imagine how long we'd live if we didn't have it? So it's crucial for our survival, but it's unpleasant. So instead of kind of avoiding pain, pain is our friend because it tells us something's wrong and this is where to look. But our worldly concerns just really panic and get taken away with it all and just try and avoid all the unpleasant things. So many people with their health, for instance, they'll just keep taking painkillers instead of going and finding out why they're in pain. I'm sure we've all done that at one time or another. And that's because our worldly concerns just go, this is painful, I don't want to know about it. Whereas if we weren't dominated by the worldly concerns, these short-term preoccupations, we go, this is painful, what's happening? What am I missing? Our pain system draws our attention to where it absolutely needs to be for our survival. So we have a physical pain system that does that. And we have an emotional pain system too. Trauma. It draws our mind to where we have to look. And if we don't deal with that, we'll just keep on having it and we'll keep on having the painkillers and nothing will get solved. The next, so are there any questions or comments about that one? Seeking all the pleasant things and avoiding all the unpleasant, whether it's things, food, relationships, people. Then we have the second pair, always seeking to have gain, profit, acquire things, get more, more is better, and being averse to loss, being upset when things deteriorate. So gain and loss, you know, so I just read in the news today this story about all of the email scams and things in Australia. And now they're on our phones and everything like that. So there is some extraordinary amount of money that is lost to scams. And I think in the last year in Australia, it was $3 billion of individuals' money that we've been scammed out of. So how does this happen? It's because we have this liking of profit. So we see a good thing. We go, oh, wow, that looks like a great investment. And we so like the idea of it that we conflate liking the idea to it being a good idea. And so then we'll hop in and we'll give them all our money. And then the other thing, the other side kicks in. We're so averse to loss. And this is what the scammers know. So you give them their, you give them $10 for an account establishment fee. Fair enough. And then they say, oh, there's been something, I need another $50 to be able to clear it because the bank did blah, blah, blah. And you go, oh, a little bit of an alarm bell rings. No, I don't know if that's right. But because you've already given the money, you don't want to go, oh, I've been scammed, I've lost $10. So you go, fair enough, I'll give you another $50 to fix it. So once that scammer's got that extra 50 out of you, they know you're a live one. You're on the hook now. They'll be able to reel you in. So I remember reading a story in the New Yorker magazine of this really rich, amazing surgeon. And he got scammed for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it's because each time they just ask for more. And his pride and his aversion to loss wouldn't let him go, oh, I've been scammed, I'm drawing a line, because then he'd have to admit I've lost all that money. So he would just keep on playing into it and give more to fix up the thing until he'd given like $300,000. So scammers know human psychology, and it's just that basic, that we want profit and we're averse to loss on a very short-term immediate level. And so when we do discover that we've been scammed and we've lost something, we can't bear it. So we just buy into it again. And that's how Australians lost $3 billion. It's not because we're not smart, it's because we're dominated by these worldly concerns. They're so deep within us. It is hard to cut your losses. If anyone's had to do that, to go, oh, well, so there's cut your losses is one, and the other, oh, good money after bad. So that's what the worldly concern does. It throws good money after bad, and so you just keep on wasting it. So they're there in our sayings, in our cliches, because it is just so in our instinct. Then we have a wish for praise and a dislike of blame or criticism or abuse. So we all crave admiration, approval. When we do something, we need someone to recognize it, to appreciate us. If we go out of our way to help someone, often we're a bit affronted if we don't get thanks. So we need that feedback from others. It's not enough. It doesn't just come from us that we do something, we've done it to the best of our ability, and we're happy. We're happy with we did our very best. We need it reflected back on us. And of course, you know, if you're in the theatre, if you're a movie star and you get a great write-up about your movie, you read it and you go, great, I'm good. I got all this praise. But there's a flip side, isn't it? You read a bad review and you go, oh no, I suck, I'm terrible. Unstable. So criticism, it's unpleasant. It makes us feel bad, usually. But actually, there's something else with criticism that's really funny. Someone can say something that's critical of us and it'll hurt us regardless of whether it's true or not. But actually, if we thought about it, if someone criticized us and it's true, wouldn't we want to know? And it's actually not their fault. They're just the messenger. It's actually true. They've just pointed something out about us. And if someone's criticized us or abused us and it's not true, why are we getting upset? Just because someone says it doesn't make it so. So all of this, you can see, it's completely illogical, which us poor human beings are: illogical, inconsistent, irrational, all of those things. We kind of forget that people can abuse us and it can just be like echoes. It doesn't mean anything. If it's not true, who cares? If it sticks, if the abuse enters into us, that's from our side, either because we're young and vulnerable, because we've been hurt before and we've got a sore spot, because we're ill, we've got low on energy, all of those things. And then the abuse kind of enters into us and hurts us. But even then, it's entirely up to us how much hurt we get. We can still make something of it. Because actually with criticism, and this flows into the next one, fear of failure, with criticism, it's actually feedback. Not nice, but hey, if it's true, we now have some extra information about things that will help us. So if we can't take criticism, we can't develop in our job, we can't get good at any activity that we do if we can't take criticism. So just sit back from over and think, oh, how well do I take criticism and how much do I shy away from it? If our whole life is dominated by a fear of criticism, we'll never be good at anything. And that's a tragedy, because we can be good at things. So the last one, success and failure. We crave fame, a good reputation, to be successful, to be, you know, at the top. We have quite a few value judgments about society, like, you know, the rich, beautiful people are more important and get showered with things, and the maids and the cleaners and the whatever, the kitchen hands, are often mistreated. They don't matter. They're swept under the carpet. So there is this whole thing with success and failure. We really crave this societal good reputation, and we can't handle failure, being seen as being a loser, being insignificant, or trying something and then having a spectacular fail. You know, our pride really can't handle that. It's hard work. But then again, you know, I just think about the various inventors throughout history and the stamina they must have had to just be a continuous failure with all of the inventions until one day it's a success. And we owe our entire civilization to that, to those inventors overcoming the worldly concern of everybody laughing at them, of failing over and over and over again. They overcame it, and now we benefit. So the eight worldly concerns, they're worldly, what it means is because they're unstable, they're very dependent on what society does, what happens to us. So it's what happens to us from the world. Whereas what we really need to do is develop a stability within our own mind so that we know our worth regardless of whether everyone's laughing at us or not. And we know we're going to keep persevering regardless if we're tired. And we're happy to persevere regardless of if we're tired and hungry. So that's really got to come from within, isn't it, rather than these worldly up and down concerns. So my question to you all then is, what's our ratio of any given day? What's the ratio that we spend being dominated by these worldly concerns? And what's the ratio that we spend on something deeper? There's no shame in saying the ratio. Put the ratio into the chat. Okay, I've just put my thing into the chat. Maybe 98%. Rachel, which way? 98%, which way? Tammy, 95% to 5, which way? 98% worldly concerns. Right, okay. This should actually give us a lot of inspiration, because just seeing it like that, we can see where we've gone wrong. It's not that there's something fundamentally wrong with us or that we don't have it in us. It's that we've been distracted. We've been concerned with things that are very fickle and unstable. And we put all that energy into them. And really, it's doing ourselves a disservice and others a disservice as well. So part of what we can think about this is, okay, so what are the things that are important to you? What are the things that really matter? So many times people will say, oh, my family or my children, you know, what are the big things that really matter to you? And then, or maybe you're trying to get a university degree, maybe trying to fulfill some of Lama Zo Rinpoche's projects. So in the scheme of things, the really big things that matter, and then how much of our everyday energy do we put into them? So this is a way of like how we try and align our values, isn't it? Of, okay, my family is the most important thing to me, or Lama Zo Rinpoche's fulfilling Rinpoche's projects, running Lungri Tampa Center, for instance, it's the most important thing to me. So how is that reflected in my activities? How is that reflected in where I put my energy? Do I put most of my energy into the thing that matters most to me? Or am I sidetracked and is it all sucked into those worldly concerns? And then I never seem to get anything done, or, you know, Rinpoche gives us a project and we go, oh, it's too hard. Instead of, yay, what a fantastic project. So we've got to align it. What matters to us, we have to put that amount, that ratio of energy into it each day. It can't just be a bucket list one day for later on. It's got to be each day. We've got to get it aligned. And so how are our daily activities each day, each week, supporting what matters to us? So it might mean, if we've got a lot of energy, it might mean working really, really hard all the time. But I found, like, in the last few years with all the upheavals of COVID and everything going online and a huge amount of behind the scenes effort, that I got completely exhausted. And I look on the news and I see with all the first responders and healthcare workers how incredibly burnt out they are. So it doesn't mean that you work all the time physically, or, you know, but it means that your purpose is all the time there. So then when you need to rest, you also go, okay, I'm going to rest so I can recuperate and continue with my life's work. So it's not like, I need a rest, I don't care about anything anymore, that's it, I'm done. You go, oh, I'm getting really burnt out, I must rest in order to be able to complete this project. So you have the pragmatic approach, but you always have that big, meaningful goal. So how about that? Does that make sense? Have you been able to do that successfully? Those of you who are workaholics, have you been able to build in some most needed rest and not feel guilty about it?
I'm trying to do that now, that whenever I eat, I'm like, well, I'm going to eat because I need to, you know, sustain this body, have the energy. When I sleep, I try to remember that I'm sleeping so I can have the energy, that sort of thing. Yeah. Trying slowly, slowly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it also means, so if you eat and it's something really delicious, then you go, that's even an added bonus, because that means I'm getting some joy and some, you know, vigor, as well as good food. And you need both to keep on going. You need to have a buoyant heart to keep on going. So Rachel, you added in there the reason why. So the other day I went out to a concert, because I've noticed that that concerts really help my mind. So because especially, say, with classical music, it's very emotional, but there's no words, and it's quite long and quite well paced. So you go, I notice I go through all of this emotional processing, and I can't skid off here or there or whatever. I'm taken through this process, and it really helps ground me, and it also helps inspire me. So every now and again, if I go off to a concert, I've noticed now this incredibly good effect it has on me, just as much as when you need good food to keep on going, how it gives you energy and it can be enjoyable. Same thing. So you can enjoy yourself too, and it makes it even more beneficial if it's for a purpose.
And I guess it's good what you said earlier about the remembering about the effort that we put in instead of just focusing on the result, because I noticed that because I've been trying to be more mindful of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, I end up beating myself up for going, oh, I've forgotten to, you know, put in the effort to do this. Anyway.
I know. Yeah. That's right. And in fact, I have a whole couple of slides about that, because it's a thing that happens to all of us. Yep. Yeah. So let's have a look. We'll get to those now then. So we've got our 8 worldly concerns. Well, that's a whole thing of itself, and it's just good to know that they're there, and that's what derails us, and to watch out for them. And then, well, why do we bite the hook? Why do we get distracted from those more meaningful things? What distracts us from the lasting happiness that we seek? So number one, the preoccupation with the worldly matters, what comes in through the senses, just entertainment, that kind of thing. They're worldly because they're unstable, they're short term, They're unreliable because they depend on others, they depend on the environment, the climate, all of these things that we have no control over. And we are enslaved by them because of this thing called cognitive fusion. And that's why we bite the hook. So cognitive fusion is something that we come back to again and again in these balancing emotions classes. And basically what it's about is that we judge the worth of our experience. We judge a good day or a bad day by the momentary emotional sensation. So if it was a fun day, we think it's a good day. And if it was a horrible day, we think it's bad. And that's called cognitive fusion. It's judging the appearance or the experience with the worth. And so then what comes next then is if it feels bad, we want to avoid it. And if it feels good, it must be good for us. So we know that's not true, because anyone who's overeaten, who's had the third helping of something delicious, knows that if it's delicious, more of it isn't necessarily better. So, again, cognitive fusion gets us because even when things go wrong, we notice, and Rachel, like, you know, you beat yourself up about it. And as long as the bad feeling lasts, we remember not to do that thing again. So if you've ever had a hangover, you have a hangover and you go, oh, I'm never going to drink again. Some very smart people actually never drink again. Other people, like me, had to learn that lesson again and again and again, because the lesson is based on the feeling. So we have the feeling, oh, I feel so terrible. This hangover, I'm never going to drink again. And we don't use an analysis to go, well, what caused it? Am I really averse to the hangover? Or is the hangover the cause of my problems? Or was it the alcohol the night before that's the cause of my problems? So once the bad feeling of the hangover goes, our understanding also goes. We forget. The bad feeling's gone. We forget. We go, oh, you know, here's a nice party or whatever. And we do it all over again. Because most of what we do is just reactive like that with emotional sensations. So we have to take the analysis in. Start with the emotional sensation and then use the analysis to bring our wisdom into it, so that next time, and people with allergies have worked this out. A lot of people, if you have a food allergy, you very quickly work out, even if I love eating that thing, I cannot eat it because I'll regret it later on. So that is working on more than just the bad feeling. It's using the analysis and mindfulness to remember. So that kind of takes us away from just being dominated by our senses. So that's why we bite the hook. Now, what can we do instead? So at the end of the day, we've got two things we can do. Dedication or aspirational prayer is a way to think of it. And so what it does is it, at the end of the day, it should mirror our morning motivation. So it's like bookends. We bookend the day. We started off with a really strong purpose. Then the whole rest of the day goes in that direction. And then at the end of the day, we remember our purpose. And then we rejoice. We look forward to the positive results. So, you know, when we're rating our day, the things that went well, yes, all the white stones, the things that went badly, the black stones, one thing I could do better. You can't leave it at that. You can't just leave it at, oh, everything went wrong. I wish I hadn't done this. I wish I hadn't done that. You have to take it a next step further and then go back to, what am I doing this for? What's the whole purpose? What are all the benefits that are going to come? Who's going to benefit? How it's going to contribute to the world? And you remember all the positive results that you're working towards. Looking forward is so important. So the reason we have to remember the positive results, it's a little bit like if you've ever tried to, here we go, if you've ever tried to learn a musical instrument. So a while ago, I mean, when I was a child, I played lots of musical instruments, but in my 40s, I tried to learn the accordion. Can't say the neighbors would have been very impressed with that. But the accordion is quite complicated. There's a whole piano keys on one side, and there's all these hundreds of little buttons on the other, and plus you've got to put the squeeze box in and out. And I was a bit overwhelmed. I thought I could just teach myself from YouTube or whatever. And so I got overwhelmed by the difficulties, and I forgot about how I wanted to sound. And that's the difference between people who pick up a musical instrument and persevere, and you pick up a musical instrument and, it's just put on a shelf somewhere. Are we focusing on the beautiful music in our head of how it's supposed to sound, and working towards that, or are we just getting overwhelmed with how difficult it is? This is hard, that's hard, oh no, another thing. That determines how we progress. So we've got to look forward to the positive results, and we have to bring our focus to it. So, Rachel, with all of the momentum for the day of striving and trying hard, then you've got to let that momentum settle and remember why, the benefits, who's benefiting, what kind of benefit you're bringing, and enjoy that. Ah, one day when I've achieved this thing, these people will be happy, these ones will be free, everything will be fine. And you start, it's called, I think sometimes it's called, in the secular world, a bright future. You imagine a bright future. In the Buddhist world, we do exactly the same thing. We imagine a bright future when everyone is liberated from samsara, born into the pure lands, enjoying the Dharma, no war, no dissatisfaction. It's incredible. And then you think, yes, through all your analysis, this is possible to bring about. And so then we get re-enthused. So how do we do it? We do it by journaling or by using prayer. So here's the other thing. Prayers are like poetry. They're inspiring, they remind us of all the important things. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, prayer is the bridge between cause and result. It's so nice, isn't it? So whenever we have whatever kind of prayer, whether we're religious or not, what it does is in our mind, it makes this bridge between our yearning for something, it connects it with it actually being able to come about. It reminds us again and again. So we that's why we have the prayers, not because there's some kind of magical abracadabra, oh Buddha or God, please make it so. What we're doing is we're bringing that bright future into reality. And how do we do that? By remembering it again and again and again, and remembering it in the most rich and inspiring way possible. So the great freedom activists throughout history, they've all thought about freeing their people, freedom for the people. They haven't thought about how bad the oppressors are. Yeah, that's come into it, but that's not the main focus. The main focus is this vision of freedom for the people. You can't sustain it otherwise. You can't sustain hatred, it'll just eat you up. You can't sustain the anger. It's got to be this bright future. So it brings a potential into reality, and by saying it with words, it makes it powerful. So instead of just having a nice idea and a nice feeling, words capture it, and how we frame it with our words determines the reality, how it's going to happen. So they're very, very powerful. In Buddhist psychology, we talk about the label. How do we label it? How do we name it? So, Denise, your difficult relative. So normally we just say, oh, my difficult relative. We all relate to that. But just changing the name to my most dear, precious relative in my family. One of my people who's so overwhelmed by negativity, I can't bear to be with them at the moment. So already it's just changed everything, hasn't it? That perspective. How I wish I could withstand their negativity and just see straight through to their good heart. So by saying the words, it helps us remember the reality. So we have to have a courage for a vast vision, a big vision. If you have a big vision, then you achieve everything in between. But it does take courage, doesn't it? And I've heard so many times, Rachel, you'll know this with at Puja, you know, we're doing our offering ceremony and then at the end and we can go around the group and people can say their dedications. And so we're all dedicating world peace, the end to the war in Ukraine and Russia, you know, the halt to climate change, dedicating for wise and compassionate politicians, all of these things. And then many times people dedicate for loved ones that are undergoing some kind of illness or emotional turmoil. But what comes out of our mouth, at least before we started training ourselves in words, is, oh, I'd like to dedicate the merits of this puja. I hope that Auntie Jill doesn't suffer too much with her cancer. And I hope it's not too bad. And when you think about it, that's a terrible dedication. It's like you're wishing them unhappiness. So why are we so impoverished with our vision? Why are we so scared to have a big vision? So actually, it takes a lot of courage to even say the words. I dedicate for Auntie Jill to be completely free of all of her sufferings, to receive all the help that she needs, for this situation to bring the family together in the best possible way. So how come we can't even go that far? And with climate change, you know, I hope it doesn't get too bad. That's no good. It's like, I dedicate that all of us right now together can harmoniously work together to save the planet, to stop polluting the planet in whatever way, small or large, that we can. If each individual did something, we could solve it. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, all of our, you know, it's human problems. They're created by humans. They can be solved by humans. So we need courage, everybody. Big-hearted courage. And from a Buddhist point of view, we don't even just dedicate to that. It might sound like a big dedication, but that's a middling dedication. What we're actually dedicating is for the complete alleviation of all sufferings for all living beings. To bring all living beings out of their suffering, scared state and into lasting happiness. Now that is probably the biggest vision you could have. And why are we so scared to even just imagine it? So I've wondered about this. How come it's so difficult? And I thought maybe because we can't bear the disappointment if it can't happen. Maybe because we don't have the confidence that it's possible, that it's just better not to even imagine it because it's so disappointing. But actually, from a Buddhist point of view, there is a deep analysis that this is possible to do. It's going to take a very long time, but it is possible by understanding the nature of our mind, the nature of phenomena. And because of understanding that mind science, because of understanding that our mind is naturally pure like the sky, it's just all that cloud and toxic pollution that's in there that creates the suffering. If we remove that toxic pollution, it will reveal the natural clarity of the mind, the luminosity of the mind. So it's possible to dedicate like that. We don't have to worry about being bitterly disappointed. So we have this big, big, vast vision, and then everything else is included in it. Auntie Jill having the best possible outcome for their cancer, you know, all of your projects, passing your exams, harmonious relationships, all of those things are included within the big one. comments, questions. What about Erin, Troy, Marnie, and Sophia? Anything to say or to put into the chat? Okay. Rachel.
I think you're right with what you were thinking, Miffy. Like, we think that when we wish for something, that we want something to happen, we think it's just wishful thinking, that just because it's in our mind, it's not real, that it doesn't mean anything. And we just kind of take it for granted that, you know, for anything to occur, for any goal to be reached, it has to start from the mind.
And I mean, for a while it is wishful thinking, but we don't have to leave it at there. And that's the brilliant thing about Buddhist psychology, is that with the analysis of that incredibly complex analysis of our mind and how it works, the more that I read about it, the more convinced I become that it's possible.
Mm.
So it goes from what initially might be wishful thinking and a nice thought or a nice feeling to being supported by evidence.
Well,
you need both.
Well, there's actually more and more studies now, I think. I haven't actually seen them myself, but a lot of people say that even just a person praying for someone, that actually already makes such a difference to the other person. I don't know how they studied that, but anyway, there's apparently evidence out there that says that just by someone praying for another person. Yeah.
There is actually. So where was it? I think it was one of the Italian centers in the FPMT. There was a study that they did, I think. So that's Lama Tsongkhapa Institute. So they did a study where they prayed for one bunch of people in a nursing home, and they prayed for another bunch of people in a nursing home. And one bunch of people knew they were being prayed for, and the other bunch of people didn't know they were being prayed for. And then there's four other dudes in the rest of the nursing home that weren't being mentioned. So they must have been just doing one particular ward. And so over the course of the study, which went over several years, they found both the bunch of people that knew they were being prayed for and the ones that didn't know were much happier. So whether you knew or not, it still had an effect on that subtle level of consciousness. And, I mean, so that's on the positive side of things. On the negative side of things, we can feel when someone's hating on us, can't we?
Yeah, someone's staring daggers behind your back.
Someone's staring daggers at us. We know.
Yeah, that's right.
And when we're having a fight with someone, even if they're not in the same room, we know. We know they're thinking bad things about us. So to a degree, it affects us because we're connected. We can always do something about it, but because we're connected. So prayers, you know, even on a level like that, just on human, because of our connectedness, have an effect. If you live in an apartment block and everyone's fighting with each other, it's awful, isn't it? It just spreads everywhere.
Mm.
If you live in an apartment block where someone's been caring for the garden and it just, you know, it's an offering for everybody else, it spreads the good vibes too. So that connectedness, it really has an effect on us. So prayer as well, it has an immediate effect as well as the long-term directing us. Okay, so in the chat, we love this concept. Our daughter who's struggling at the moment with anxiety would benefit to reach outside of herself to affect another person on a spiritual level. I think it's a beautiful idea to dedicate to somebody for a higher purpose. Yeah, so one of the easiest and nicest things, especially for anxiety, is just reaching out to care for an animal. So, you know, for autistic kids, they have the horse therapy, going horse riding. Also for rehabilitation for prisoners, really, you know, nasty sounding prisoners, there's been a couple of programs, one to tame the horses, look after the horses, and another one to adopt a dog and train a dog. And just that connection between an animal who is not going to lie to you, who's completely honest, you know, two beings like that, it's incredibly restorative. So the prisoners that have gone through this program, it's helped with all of their brutalization and past trauma, and it's often the very first positive relationship that they've had. The autistic kids with the horses and the kids seem to be able to have this communication. It's not words based, it's not overwhelming like that. And so when it comes to loneliness and anxiety, just caring for one other being, it's such an honest relationship and it's so restorative. And I think also there's been studies that even if that being isn't a dog or a cat that you can cuddle, which is an added bonus, having that physical contact, even if it's a bird or a fish, still has incredibly positive benefits because it takes us outside of ourselves. And many times people have said, you know, the only reason I didn't commit suicide was because who was going to feed the dog tomorrow, and I couldn't do it to the dog. So this just living for one other person, let alone all sentient beings, but for one other person, helps us. And that way, the animals get to make their life most meaningful and beneficial too. So then us as humans, so we've got two cats and they've been my wonderful companions. I don't think I would have got through the whole COVID upheaval 3 years without them, no way. And so I dedicate for them. Thank you, dear cats. You've done a good job being part of the household. You've fulfilled your side of the bargain. You let me cuddle you. You've been entertaining. And in turn, I dedicate for your welfare, for your liberation and enlightenment. And because of that connection between us, it's going to help them. In fact, I can hear one of them yelling out the door now because he can hear me talking. He's like, let me in. I know you're in there. Yes. And so then the higher purpose, then regardless of whether you are actually involved in something, regardless of whether we're actually involved in saving the planet or halting climate change, you can still dedicate for it. So you can still determine, may all of these good things come to pass, and may I be involved somehow in bringing them to fruition. But you dedicate for the saving of this planet, for wise and compassionate politicians. Every day. And if you have that in your mind, that really fierce goodness and positivity, that will affect things, whether you're actually going out and voting or not. It really affects things, just like in an apartment block, if everyone's peaceful or if they're all fighting, it just affects things. So don't think just because you're not talking to anyone or you don't have any political power that you don't have any spiritual power. You do. Oh, great. So thank you. She's incredibly close to her animals. Without words, they have a strong bond. That's right. So you can be very helpful. So get some nice prayers that she can read to them, some mantras, some of the sutras. So it benefits your daughter and it benefits the animals because they hear it and it's imprints on their mind. And then next time when they're reborn, they go to a good country, a good family, where they'll hear those sutras. And because animals don't have the intellectual barriers, doubt and academia and all of that, animals, they're just pretty upfront, aren't they? So when you say things to them, especially the words of the Buddha and the sutras, it goes deep into their mind. Much deeper than when it goes into the minds of human beings, because we're so distracted and preoccupied with other things. So it's very powerful saying mantras, even just the mantra of compassion, Om Mani Padme Hum. If you just recite that to the animals, it'll bless them. And then there's something we can do for them. All right, so the last slide then is, how do we dedicate? How do we internalize the positive experiences that we have? How do we capture them, feel them, use them, dedicate them? So we dedicate them to our purpose. We use our words. But how do we, you know, like Rachel on Sunday when we, when the refuge ceremony ended, it's just like it's all over and poof, it's gone. So how do we capture it and kind of let it settle within us? So this is where positive psychology really comes into its own. So we've got to turn positive facts, a good thing happened, into positive experiences. We have to experience it and draw that experience out for an amount of time. So we remember it and it settles into our mind and continues to affect us. So one of the things is to actually spend some time recognizing when good things happen to us, acknowledging them, going, wow, this was a historical event. So many people were there. They were also beaming and happy. So these are all facts. And all these auspicious signs, it's so rare to be able to take refuge. It's so rare to be able to have a geshe. We're able to do it in a nice center with clean water and air conditioning instead of a dusty temple in India with dysentery and, you know, like all of these good things. We've got a great bunch of people around us. So you think about all of the facts, as many as you can, all the benefits. Take your time. Don't skimp over it. Really try and bring every single possible detail that you can. The physical sensations, the rewarding emotional experience. Try and spend on each of those details 5 or 10 seconds just contemplating it and feeling how good it was. And all the benefits, the bright future. And then think how amazing. So the rejoicing, it doubles your merit, it doubles your energy. How fantastic to have spent our life like this, doing this thing. Savor the experience. So how do we savor it? We've got to use our imagination, all of our senses. We imagine it as a pleasant physical sensation. And we stay with the emotional reward of it. So here's some examples how we can do it. And we can do this since we're just on 8 o'clock. We can dedicate tonight and this whole course. By doing this, savoring the experience. So one way that you can imagine the experience absorbing into you as a pleasant physical sensation with, you know, lots of meaning like a metaphor is imagine all of the aha moments as like jewels filling your heart. So your heart is a treasure chest. And every time you went, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And every time a light bulb moment came and every time you had some resolution, every time you got inspired, all the different myriad jewels, they're just falling there into that treasure chest of your heart. And so that's the real investment. Those jewels, they're precious, they're beautiful, they're there to pull out and use again and again, all of those realizations, all of those aha moments, and you treasure them. That's what's important. Another way that you can do it is that you can think that through all the effort, then it's like a rainfall of light, like light beams from all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas showering down on you, like a beautiful summer rain after a really hot day, you know, quenching all the fires of distress and clinging and turmoil, this beautiful rain, sweet summer rain. Showers of light raining into you, and all of that light absorbs into your nervous system, and your whole nervous system becomes illuminated and energized, and every atom becomes radiant. There's a third one you can do. Imagine everything is like celestial music, harmonizing your body and mind, so that everything that we've learned and heard about, it begins to harmonize our life. Our life becomes aligned. What matters to us and how we act. Our values are reflected in our activities. It becomes harmonious. And our activities become harmonious with reality, with our potential. And this manifest as the beautiful celestial music of the spheres, as they say, as harmony, literally, and how beautiful harmonies are. So all of that positive energy, just like music, is the disturbance of air, it's energy. So all of that good intentions and effort is this musical melody of your life, coming to a resolution, coming to a beautiful harmony. Your whole body and mind become aligned. So the benefit of dedicating like this is that we've thought about all of the facts of the situation, how beneficial it is. It's mirrored our morning. And now we've turned it into an experience that uses our imagination and all of our senses. And our body, our nervous system, can't tell the difference between what's imaginary and what's real. If you imagine light flowing into your body's going to eventually feel it as if it's happening. If you imagine everything being harmonious and humming in a beautiful harmony with energy, eventually your body is going to feel that and you will be harmonious and humming with energy. Your nervous system can't tell the difference between real and imagined. Same, same. So it has this very powerful effect on us. So just before we do our read our dedication, it's important to do this, to savor it at the end of the day. Think of your bright future. Go to sleep imagining that bright future, the kind of person that you want to wake up as tomorrow, kind, wise, compassionate, full of energy, and that's the state of mind that you go to sleep in. And so then to dedicate, then we dedicate for the big one, isn't it? For our own enlightenment, so that as a fully awakened being, a Buddha, we can perfectly help all others who are suffering just as we are and need it, often even more help than we do. So we dedicate for our full enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. That's the big one. And then everything else in between, all of our passion projects and our prayers for everybody, just like our lamas dedicate for us all the time. Rachel, all of our lamas are dedicating for you. Whether you are aware of it or not, they're still dedicating for you. So we can be taken up with that as well. And then, so we've dedicated for the big one, and then we dedicate as a human being, may we always be able to benefit and never harm anybody. And then this dedication that we've been doing at the end of each class. So just wait till it loads. Okay, so here we go. Let's read this. Due to all the merits of the three times accumulated by me and by others, merely by seeing, hearing, remembering, touching, or talking to me, may any being be freed in that very second from all of their sufferings, diseases, spirit harms, negative karmas, and obscurations, and abide in the peerless happiness of full enlightenment forever. So that means that just by you existing in the world, and just by your daughter existing in the world, anyone who sees her, hears her, remembers her, touches her, the cats, the dogs, or whatever, talks to her, is benefited. For all of us, whenever we're out in the world, just by people seeing us, we become a connector between them and the Buddha Dharma. Whoever speaks to you on the phone is blessed. Whoever sees you on Facebook is blessed. Even anyone who thinks of you in anger, I hate them, they're blessed just by thinking of you, whether it's peacefully or with anger, it helps them. So you can dedicate anything like this. You can dedicate a good meal that you've cooked. You can dedicate crochet. You can dedicate your university degree. You can dedicate feeding the cat or the dog. You can dedicate cleaning the house. And you dedicate it in this way, it becomes a cause for enlightenment and the benefit of all sentient beings. So you make every moment of your life really powerful then. So we think, you know, due to the power of dependent arising, we dedicate in this way, in the best possible way, then everything will follow. So that's taken us to the end of the class tonight. And thanks for coming along. What a nice surprise to have you all here. Next week is Anzac Day, so it's public holiday, so there's no class. And then the week after that, the first Tuesday in May, we start with the in-person classes at Lungri Tungpa Centre. So it'll be Carolyn Mason leading the Four Immeasurable Attitudes. It's a really great, again, it's about a bit of Buddhist meditation, a bit of Buddhist psychology. It's going to be worthwhile whether you're religious or not, whether you're Buddhist or not. It's the universal qualities, compassion, kindness, equanimity, joyous energy. So that'll be in person, same time at 6:30, first Tuesday in May. And it's all May, all the Tuesdays. So take care, everyone. Thank you so much for coming along, and might see you in person at the centre. Otherwise, there's always other things on online, so I'll see you in the online universe as well.
Thank you so much, Riffy. Thank you, everyone.